Welcome to the What Even Is podcast, where we interview experts about different topics that makes us wonder, what even is that? Or what even is that like? I'm your host, Donna Trung. Let's get started. Today, we're answering what even is a midwife with our guest who has been a certified professional midwife for 8 years, an international board certified lactation consultant, a faculty member of the Birthwise Midwifery School, where she teaches the next generation of midwives, and is the owner of the Two Rivers Lactation Midwifery Clinic in Yarmouth, Maine, Tiffany Carter Skillings. So starting with our first question, what is a midwife and like what responsibilities do midwives do?
Yeah, so the word midwife means with woman. And so the entire profession is based around caring for women or other bodies that are XX, and most of it being focused on our reproductive years. So that's not true for every midwife. Some midwives specialize in caring for people with menopause. Some people work in clinical settings where they take care of younger people, usually people who have already hit puberty and then beyond. There's a great focus on caring for people during pregnancy, during labor and birth, and during the postpartum time.
That's so interesting because I wouldn't know that midwives also help people with who specialize in menopause. I always just thought it was like people who are about to give birth and then, you know, that's when the midwife kicks in. But I didn't realize it was like even after that too.
Yeah. Yep. It's an important, you know, change in our reproductive lives, whether that's approaching menopause, so that's known as perimenopause, reaching menopause, so that very last menstrual, you know, period and going 12 months beyond it, as well as the changes that happen in the body after that and at times require some support. So midwives have always been, since, you know, the beginning of humankind, focusing on the whole breadth of the life cycle, especially during the childbearing phase.
Right. So then when you were a CNA, what made you want to become, like, what was the switch to be like, oh, I don't want to just be a CNA. I want to do something more like being like a midwife.
Yeah. So when I was in college, I actually majored in sociology with a concentration in criminology because I was on the pre-law track. And then second semester of senior year, I took a course in sociology, an introductory course, just because I needed one more course to complete my major. And it was the sociology of health and illness. And partway through the course, it was like a light bulb went off and I was like, wait a minute, I don't want to do law. Why have I never considered, you know, this completely different pathway in healthcare? So right after graduating from college, I started working in various entry-level jobs in healthcare because it was such a new concept to me. I had been wanting and craving becoming a lawyer since I was 8 years old, and then all of a sudden had this big switch at, you know, 21 years old and didn't really know a lot about healthcare and didn't really know if I wanted to have boots on the ground or more study it from a sociological perspective. So I started working at a resident care facility or assisted living facility. I worked in an outpatient family practice and pediatrics office, which was really exciting, doing medical assisting work. I decided to work in the hospital for a little while as a certified nursing assistant for two different hospitals here in Maine. One is a large tertiary care center, and I was in the float pool. So I had the opportunity to float to every single, just about every department within the hospital, just really, if I can say it, on a fact-finding mission, like, you know, what does a nurse do? What does it look like to be a physician assistant? What does a respiratory therapist do, or physical therapist, you know, really looking at it all. And there was one night when I was working in the float pool, and basically for someone who doesn't know, in the float pool, the goal is to have extra staff that can plug in to various places when there's a staffing shortage. So I was moved 3 times in one night. And that was a little unsettling to me because I was starting to realize that I really appreciated more continuity of care and getting to know people over time and developing relationships with them. And that can't really happen when you've moved 3 times in a 12-hour shift. And then on that third assignment, I was on a cardiac floor where people tend to have open heart surgeries and are recovering. And as I was floating, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I went through and still took a peek at everyone to make sure that everybody that I had just inherited in my assignment was okay. And just one person was sitting up at the edge of the bed. Everyone else was asleep. So I poked my head into the room and just said, like, hey, you know, I'm Tiffany. I'm going to be working with you tonight. Are you doing okay? And he grumbled, like, oh, what do you want? And I was like, I don't really want anything. I just, you're the only person on the floor that's up right now. Are you okay? You know, are you thinking about something? Are you in pain? And he's like, you know, I've been here for 13 days and you're the first person to just come in and ask me if I was doing okay without it being tied to a care measure, like checking my incision site or checking my blood sugar or listening to my heart. And that was, you know, something that really like cinched the deal for me, is once again, having that continuity of care and really getting to know people and have relationships. As far as then how does that translate to being a midwife? It was actually through my own brief pregnancy and miscarriage experience that I started kind of learning, or I should say relearning, about midwives. It was just sort of like, oh, okay, well, I'm pregnant. So now what? I guess you get an OB. Oh, well, actually, no, they're midwives. You know, OBs aren't the only option. And oh goodness, you know, people birth not only in the hospital, but in birth centers and at home. And it just really sparked a big interest in me. And as I started doing more of that learning and relearning, I realized I've had midwives in my life for a really long time. My mom has seen a midwife for her well woman care for a really long time. And I just sort of forgot about that. When I worked in a bakery, someone I worked alongside in that bakery had been a midwife for some time and talked about her adventures as a midwife, which I always found fascinating, but forgot about it. I had friends that had a home birth and had sort of like dismissed it because I was like, oh, well, you know, that's those guys. They live off the grid. Of course, they had a home birth. But so essentially all the seeds had been planted previously over the years. And then the experiences of working in healthcare and my own miscarriage experience were, you know, ended up being the water for those seeds, you know. And anyway, after that experience of miscarrying 9 months later, I was fully enrolled in midwifery school.
Oh, that's so cool. It's so cool because it kind of comes back full circle. It's like, you don't realize that it's like there, but then you're just like, oh, wait, why didn't I think of this beforehand?
Exactly. Exactly.
So what I was always confused about, I don't know the difference between like a midwife and a doula. So like, what's the difference?
That's a great question. So a doula is someone who provides non-clinical or non-medical care and usually really tunes into someone's need for physical comfort and support while they're laboring, really tuned into their emotional and even spiritual needs during the course of labor, and oftentimes serves as an advocate. And some of that advocacy work begins prenatally, where we start to learn, if you know, one is serving as a doula, start to learn what the client desires or what their birth plan or birth vision, you know, is what's important to them, so that when they are doing the work of labor, hopefully they can fully drop into their body and let their body do the work and, you know that there will be people there, whether a birth partner or a doula, to kind of speak up for them. And I do that to some degree. You know, as a midwife, I am tuned in to making sure that people are coping well physically and providing the hands-on physical support continuously, and also tuning into their emotional and spiritual needs. I provide prenatal care. So I do see my clients sometimes 10 plus times during the course of their pregnancy, where I'm focused on not only the pieces I just described, but also the more clinical or medical aspects, like how is their blood pressure doing? Is that staying in a safe range? Checking their urine at every visit, checking on their baby's position within the womb, you know, knowing if the baby's head down or if the baby's breech ahead of time is really important, listening to the baby's heartbeat. And then that extending into the process of labor and birth, where again, I carry a lot of clinical responsibility in caring for both the pregnant person and their baby. And then, you know, that transitioning into the postpartum piece. And my scope of practice, I'm a licensed certified professional midwife here in Maine. And so my scope of practice includes care of the well newborn up to 6 weeks of life. So these guys have been a unit, you know, all throughout pregnancy and all throughout labor. And just because this baby is outside of their body, usually the birthing parent and baby are still very much interdependent. If I ask during a postpartum visit, like, well, Donna, tell me, how's your sleep? Your answer is going to be, well, the baby. And like, well, you know, how's nursing going? Well, the baby, you know, you can't really separate the two. So I care for both of them. But again, the focus is more on the clinical or medical aspects and not just kind of physical comfort.
I'm just going to reiterate just to make sure I'm understanding correctly. So the doula is mainly, it's not so much the clinical stuff. It's just more about like the emotional and just making sure they're okay and coming up with like a birth plan and all that, right?
Yeah. And they might even do things like massage, you know, the client, or provide counter pressure on their hips, encourage them to try different positions during labor. And they're a really important part of the healthcare team. But they, again, they're not evaluating the baby's heart rate, or they're not doing cervical checks to check for dilation. They're just not doing those clinical pieces.
Right. And then you said that you do prenatal care too, but not all midwives do prenatal care, right?
Yeah, so midwives work in all kinds of settings. Like you might find midwives working in a clinic setting like family planning or Planned Parenthood, for example. So not necessarily focusing on taking care of pregnant people.
Okay. All right. So then what's the pro of having a midwife versus like an OB?
Ooh, well, some of the pros would be that for one, we as midwives really understand that being pregnant, birthing, being in the postpartum time, that these are normal phases in someone's reproductive life and really try to support someone in having a foundation of wellness. As opposed to what sometimes happens in the obstetrical model is a tendency to look for pathology, looking for the things that are going wrong. And of course, we care for people who are healthy and low risk, so we're less likely to, you know, see those complications come up, but we are trained to recognize them and to manage them or to get them into obstetrical care as appropriate. The other piece, you know, we tend to develop, I think, a different relationship with our clients. The type of midwife that I am as a certified professional midwife in particular, we tend to spend more time with our clients. A prenatal visit could be anywhere from 20 to 60 minutes long, depending on where that the midwife is practicing. Whereas it's more common to only have maybe 7 minutes or 15 minutes with an OB. So not as much time to kind of talk and connect. The other piece would be the continuity of care. Again, kind of midwife that I am, I'm the only midwife that practices here, you know, at Two Rivers. And so what that means is that all the prenatal visits are with me and I am at the labor and birth. I do have a team, another midwife that attends the birth with me, but I do all of the postpartum visits, newborn care. So, you know, by the time we're hitting labor and birth, which is a pretty momentous experience and pretty intimate, you know, it feels like we've had the time to build relationship and build trust between one another. And sometimes that doesn't happen in an OB setting. Once again, there's just not as much time. There's a tendency to have a number of providers that are rotating and you never know who's actually going to be the person, you know, at the birth, for example.
Right. So then you said how you can like recognize, well, what would make someone like high risk, like in a high risk pregnancy?
You know, some examples would be having what we call a hypertensive disorder or high blood pressure in pregnancy. And if it's not responding to, you know, tools like nutrition and exercise, stress management, maybe some supplementation, or sometimes we use herbs, botanical medicine, then that person would really be safer giving birth under obstetrical care and in a hospital setting. Someone who has gestational diabetes that can only be managed or controlled with medication, I would say that they would be best served in the hospital setting. There's some conditions that are, you know, up for debate. Some things like having a baby in a breech position. So this is where either the bottom, you know, would be coming out first or the feet would be coming out first. And there are midwives who are trained to what we call catch, deliver breech babies. And there's some midwives that don't have that training. And there's a lot of debate as to whether or not that puts someone in a high risk category and do they need to give birth only in the hospital. Another topic for debate would be multiples, having twins or others like triplets and so on. There's some midwives who are trained and feel really comfortable delivering twins outside of the hospital and in a community-based setting. And that, you know, some that would say, nope, that needs to happen in the hospital. So there's some, you know, really clear conditions that would cause someone to risk out of midwifery care, especially, I guess we should distinguish, there are midwives that do practice in the hospital and then there are midwives who practice in community-based settings like a birth center or home birth. And so there's some things that fall under the umbrella of midwifery care. And then there's some, you know, that umbrella is a little bit smaller when we're talking about giving birth outside of the hospital with a midwife because of the differences in resources.
You said like when there's high blood pressure, why does that make someone high risk?
Well, so when there's high blood pressure, we have restricted blood flow to the uterus or the womb where the baby is growing, and that can create complications in the baby's ability to grow. We often see babies become growth restricted. There are some hypertensive disorders or high blood pressure disorders, such as preeclampsia, that actually can cause organ damage to the pregnant parent, liver damage, kidney damage, for example, and if untreated, can cause seizures in the pregnant person, which poses a great risk to both the parent and the baby. There's another variation under that hypertensive disorder known as HELLP syndrome that, you know, we literally start seeing red blood cells and platelets being destroyed in addition to that organ damage that can happen. So those are things that require much closer monitoring or would be higher risk and therefore need either obstetrical care or in some cases, maternal fetal medicine care, which is, you know, the high risk perinatal providers.
So you do home births, right?
I do at this time. Yep. I have worked in a birth center setting before, but now I focus only on home birth.
In your professional opinion, what's the difference between like home births versus like a hospital birth?
Yeah, I mean, home birth, of course, the person who is laboring or the family, they are, you know, in their own setting. And in that way, being on their own territory, have a lot more freedom. And I think people feel empowered in a different way to be an active participant in the decision-making process, or just even speaking up when something's not working for them, which might not feel as comfortable in a hospital setting. The tendency is to use more hands-on techniques and continuous being present with people, again, midwife being with women, you know, just really being present to people, more monitoring vital signs, we're monitoring and evaluating fetal heart rate on a regular basis, as well as some other pieces. We're using different technology. For example, we use a handheld Doppler for that, as opposed to continuous electronic fetal monitoring, which is standard of care in the hospital setting. And studies have said, you know, for someone that's healthy and low risk, that using that electronic fetal monitoring doesn't actually improve outcomes. And it actually kind of makes people feel restricted. While there are some wireless options for the fetal monitoring in the hospital setting, many of them are wired in, and people feel like they're tethered to a machine and can't be upright and mobile in terms of actively participating in their baby's birth. And we know that being upright, being in forward leaning positions, being open really helps to facilitate birth. Again, you know, you've got that continuity of care where someone is continuously present and monitoring what is happening and watching what is happening, as opposed to in the hospital setting. While that would be true of the nurse that's assigned to take care of the person in labor, they tend to spend a lot of time in the room. That's not universally true. Sometimes nurses do get pulled away from the bedside and at the nursing station. And the providers often take care of multiple people. So whether that's a nurse midwife in the hospital setting or an OB, you know, they may be taking care of 7, 5, 8, you know, however many people, and kind of dashing back and forth between room to room. Whereas at a home birth, you know, if you're my client, then my focus is 100% on you. And that's really lovely, I think, not only from the client side, but even the provider side. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are some of the differences. In the hospital setting, there tends to be, again, because you're taking care of more people, the systems are compartmentalized. So everybody has a different job, right? There's a phlebotomist that comes in to draw your blood. There is a nurse who is monitoring baby's heart rate. There's, you know, the doctor that comes in to do a cervical check and talk about a couple of things and then leaves. The pharmacist is dispensing, you know, your medications, as opposed to, you know, again, home birth, the midwife is sort of the one-man show and is the person doing all of those pieces. And it means that you end up in the hospital meeting a lot of different people, which may make the experience feel less private, less intimate. And sometimes it's harder to really just kind of open up and dilate when it doesn't feel as private. The lack of the continuity of care, there's shift change. And sometimes that works to someone's benefit, where they're like, oh, you know, I feel like I'm not really jiving with this nurse. I'm really excited for shift change. And then you get the really awesome nurse, or sometimes it doesn't work in your favor. You love the nurse that you have, and then you're nervous about shift change. And it doesn't mean that nurses, they're good nurses or bad nurses. It's all about, you know, personalities, you know, really connecting with one another, especially through something like birth. I think the last and kind of the biggest difference is that, you know, the hospital kind of has all of the tools and has all of the resources, you know. So if you're ever thinking about worst case scenario, if worst case scenario is likely to happen, as, you know, can be the case in a high risk pregnancy, then being in the hospital where you have immediate access to all of those tools can feel really good and can feel really supportive. For someone who's healthy and low risk, sometimes being in that setting where those tools are much more likely to be used, even if they're not really indicated, you know, every intervention has the potential to help, but it also has the potential to cause harm or has some limitations. And so sometimes we're using tools in that setting that don't clearly add benefit and only kind of introduce risk. And so some people would say, I'd rather feel, you know, start at home. I feel more supported and safer if I start at home. And then if we see there's a clear reason to be in the hospital, to then move and transition into that setting and access those tools. But I don't want to use those tools. I don't even want to be tempted to use those tools unless I really need to.
So I have so many questions just based off of what you said. Okay. So number one, what is a Doppler? That's what you said what it's called, where they monitor you guys monitor like the baby and everything, right?
Yeah. So a Doppler is a handheld device or tool that we use to listen to a baby's heartbeat. It uses ultrasound technology, but this is an ultrasound technology where we only get to hear the heartbeat. We don't actually get to see it beating. So a little bit different from what some people think about you know, for obstetric ultrasound where they actually get a picture of the baby. Midwives also use other even lower tech tools like a fetoscope, which is basically a stethoscope that is placed on the abdomen so we can listen to a baby's heartbeat, but baby needs to be a little bit more mature for us to hear. And the Doppler, we can hear, you know, sometimes as early as 8 weeks, depending on the strength of your Doppler, 8 weeks gestation. My Doppler happens to be waterproof because I attend a lot of water births, or a lot of my clients choose to labor in water, even if they don't birth in water. And so mine is capable of doing that monitoring underwater.
Okay, cool. That's another question, but let me just make sure I get all my questions out. Okay, so you remember how you said multiples can be considered high risk for some like midwives and stuff?
Sure.
So why? Because isn't it just like another baby coming out or something?
When you have more than one baby occupying that space, there's some tricky things that can happen. For example, there's a tendency for babies to not always be in the most optimal position for birth. You might have one baby that's head down, but another baby that's in a breech position, for example. And some midwives are really skilled at being able to manage that second baby coming through, breech. And there's some midwives that don't have that experience or that training. The other piece is that, without going into all the examples, sometimes twins, these little love bugs, they share one placenta. And so sometimes in sharing that one placenta, one love bug gets all of the resources and the other little love bug does not get very much. And so you can see big disconcordance in sizes of babies. One baby that's really small and growth restricted or malnourished, and the other baby is healthy and thriving, for example. And that requires extra monitoring in the pregnancy and even during the labor and the birthing process, for example.
I had another question, but I completely... Oh, water birth. Yes, water birth.
Yeah.
So why do people choose... Because you said some people choose to like labor in water. Well, what's the benefits of having like a water birth, by the way?
Yeah. So water, over the history of mankind, it seems that women in particular have been very drawn to water, and we tend to be very connected with the moon cycles that influences water on the planet and in our bodies. And so it just seems like something that people are really drawn to. And what we find in research is that it helps to improve the experience of labor. It helps us to cope with the sensations of labor. You know, we think about labor, we often think about pain, but there's stretching, there's pulling, there's pressure, there's tightening. I mean, there's all these different sensations that are happening oftentimes at the same time. And it really helps to bring a lot more comfort. It helps to lower blood pressure, and it can certainly help with getting into certain positions that someone might feel more challenged doing on like dry land, if you will, because of the weightlessness of being in water. It helps to decrease the risk of tearing during the process of birth because it brings extra blood flow into the tissues, into the birth canal and on the outside of the vagina as well. And that results in more healthy stretching as opposed to tearing of tissues. It also makes for a really gentle transition for the baby. The baby was living within water and then makes this gentle transition into water and then outside of water, to the point that we see babies who are alert, eyes are wide open, they're taking everything in, their heart is beating normally, they're breathing, and they're not crying. They're just looking around and taking it in. Whereas, you know, I think most people have this vision of like babies being born on dry land, if you will, not in water, and they come out and they're immediately crying. The babies born in water tend to be much more mellow and yet doing just fine. Not everybody loves being in water, especially for the pushing part. Some people feel like they do need to be out of the birth pool to feel grounded enough to push their babies out once they're in that part of their labor. But yeah, a lot of people seem really drawn to it. And once you get people in the pool, it's often a struggle to get them out. You know, like, you've been sitting in this pool for 2 hours. We should move around. And they're like, no.
Well, is it like a hot tub kind of? Like, not like too hot, but it's like lukewarm water, or...
Yeah, we try to keep it closer to body temperature, like 98 degrees, and we monitor the temperature because we don't want to overheat either party. And if it's too cold, it actually increases the pain of labor.
Oh, that makes sense, because your muscles are like tensing up, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole fear, tension, pain cycle. And certainly the fear part doesn't have to apply here, but you know, when we are afraid, we tend to tense up, and the more tense we are, the greater the pain experience, and the more pain that we're experiencing, the more afraid we become, and the more tense, you know, and it's a terrible cycle to get stuck in.
Right. I think it's kind of cool though, because with the water birth, because you said it doesn't tear as much, that's a big bonus.
Yeah, that's one thing that I know for myself as a midwife, and I think this is true for most midwives, that we try really, really hard to be sure to protect the perineum whenever possible. And that may be having someone labor in water, that may be using warm compresses against the perineum, even sometimes directing someone's attention to their pushing efforts. I mean, pushing is hard work. It really is. Labor's hard work. But sometimes right at that maximal point of stretching that we call crown, that sensation is so intense and sometimes so overwhelming that people just want to blast the baby out at that moment to make the feeling go away. Mm-hmm. But then that promotes more tearing. And so trying to get someone to be like present with that feeling and let that feeling be their guide so they can ease their baby out the last bit of the way can help to minimize the risk of tearing or to minimize tearing if it does happen.
Oh, interesting. Okay, next question. So how does training look for you guys? Do you guys have like a fake diet, like those plastic models of like the birth canal and then.
Well, the U.S. is quite a funny place in that there's so many different pathways for training to become a midwife. And as a result, there are different credentials for becoming a midwife. When you look at other countries like Canada or UK, Australia, New Zealand, you know, like you look at these other examples and a midwife is a midwife is a midwife. You all get trained the same way. You all have the same credential and therefore all have the same scope of practice. And this is not true in the U.S. So again, going back to the fact that I'm a licensed certified professional midwife, I did go to a 3-year accredited midwifery school. And the first year and a half was focused more on the like didactic portion. So sitting in a classroom setting, learning from, you know, instructors and really having, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but kind of a diverse curriculum where we're not only learning, you know, about midwifery in and of itself, but we're taking courses with someone who specializes in social work. So we can learn more about like perinatal mood disorders, for example, you know, really a nice broad, you know, education as well as the specifics that we needed. We did do some clinical training in the classroom with models. For example, if you're learning how to palpate a belly to do what we call Leopold's maneuvers to assess the baby's position from within the womb, like we practiced on models. And then we scaled up to practicing on, you know, people under supervision. And we do clinical rotations during that first year and a half. So we have, we call them a preceptor, but basically a clinical instructor in the field where another midwife takes us under their wing and brings us to prenatal visits and brings us to births and, you know, really shows us what things look like in the field because life is not, life doesn't really happen like the textbooks. And then the last year and a half is focused on just the hands-on learning. So we're in an internship similar to a residency where you become a primary midwife under supervision. So you're leading the care, you know, whether in a prenatal visit, during birth, postpartum visit, but again, all under the supervision of another midwife and basically stretching your legs as an independent midwife and really getting to see quite a lot, not just normal, but when things get complicated and learning how to manage those while there's somebody, you know, in the wings who can step in and take over if need be, or provide that, you know, critical appraise that like you did well, or you needed to, you know, look at this or that. And then we take an exam, kind of like a boards, an 8-hour exam in order to become a certified professional midwife.
So then when you were, the first time you actually delivered a baby, were you like nervous?
Yeah, actually, because this happened in a practice where there are usually two midwives. And so a group practice, they always work together. And it was a home birth. They did both home and birth center birth. And for whatever reason, one of the midwives, you know, got there in due time. And I was with that midwife. The second midwife, however, ended up getting held up with something and didn't make it to the birth. And all of a sudden, the labor that had been kind of steadily plodding along accelerated. And next thing you know, this mom is pushing and grunting. And the, you know, I happened to be standing by the tub because I had listened to the baby's heartbeat. And I told the midwife, like, the head is coming out. And she was like, stay right there. Don't move. Put your hands out. And I was like, but aren't you going to get in here to catch the baby? And she was scrambling in the background to get things kind of, you know, ready because again, things just like turned the corner so quickly and the other midwife wasn't there. And she was like, nope, you're catching this baby. And I was like, what? And then I was like, okay, I'm catching this baby. And I put my game face on and I caught that baby. It was my very first catch. It wasn't planned. It wasn't talked about ahead of time, but she knew that the other midwife wasn't going to make it. I didn't know that. I was still kind of like, where's the other midwife? When is she going to get here? But I have to say, I'm the kind of person that
maybe I'm not this way now, but at the time I was the kind of person that I never really felt ready to do anything. So if someone had asked me like, hey, do you feel comfortable catching this baby? I would have said like, no, thanks. I think I'll watch you this time and maybe next time. And so a lot of my experiences in that practice, I think they knew this about my personality. It was just like, okay, Tiffany's going to do this now. And I was like, oh my gosh, I am. And then I was like, okay, I am. And I would do it and I would do it well. Like it went way better than I ever thought, you know, it would. But I had a lot of experiences that as a midwifery student of just like, you're doing it.
You're like, okay, I guess I'm doing it now.
Exactly.
So someone told me that pushing takes like an hour. Is that true?
Oh, it depends. So the average for a first-time person, if we're talking about they're healthy, they're low risk, and they're not using medication for pain control, the average would be 2 hours of pushing. With an epidural in place, it can be the average is 3 hours for someone birthing for the first time.
Oh my God.
And it may not be pushing continuously. I mean, you push along with contractions and those contractions may be happening, you know, every 2 to 3 minutes and lasting 60 to 90 seconds. So you get these little breaks in between. But yeah, it's a lot of work to, it feels like the birth canal is a mile long, but it isn't.
It's so funny because on TV, they always make it seem like it's like a couple minutes. And that's just legit what I thought it was. It would take like a couple minutes and you're like, it's like out. But then when I went to like my hairstylist, she was like, oh no, I took like an hour. And I was like, what?
Yeah, it definitely can take a lot longer than that. And I mean, that's the average, right? So that means that there's some people who are able to birth their babies much more quickly than that. And that's more common when people have given birth before, even folks that we would call grand mal tips, they're having baby number 6, baby number 10, baby number 13. Those births happen very quickly. The water breaks at the last minute and the baby just comes flying out in one or two pushes. And then there are people on the other end of that curve, right? Where it might take them 3 hours or 4 hours to push out their baby. So they're talking about averages, but there's a spectrum.
Is it because they have more muscle? Like they use the muscles to push the other babies out, so it's easier for them? And then like, whereas new moms...
I think there's so many pieces to that. I think for one, all of those tissues know how to stretch because they've stretched multiple times to the point that sometimes there's not a lot of resistance there. Whereas someone who's doing it for the first time, those tissues have never stretched. Some of us who have a lot of pelvic tone, like, you know, people who specialize in yoga or, you know, other things where they're just focusing on bringing a lot of tone there, kind of getting those muscles to stretch, you know, take some work, especially if we want to maintain the health and integrity of those tissues and not have a lot of tearing. And I think there's also a different level of confidence that I see in those people who are having baby number 10, for example. It's just like, okay, I know this part is going to be really hard and it hurts, but if we just do it, you know, 10 minutes later, I'll have a baby in my hands, you know, so break my water and let's do it, you know? Whereas sometimes there's some trepidation on the part of, you know, someone birthing for the first time. There's a learning curve, learning to find the muscles that are used to birth a baby. Sometimes that takes time. So you see someone who's been pushing for 30 minutes or pushing for an hour and they're not really moving baby. And then all of a sudden something clicks and they found those muscles and now they're moving baby really well.
Do Kegels help?
Sure. I mean, like having pelvic strength can help, but also like having so much that we don't know how to like release and let go can be counterproductive.
Oh, right. Yeah, that makes sense. So since you provide prenatal care, do you guys provide like midwives who work in prenatal care? Do you guys provide like nutritional advice or like exercise advice? Like, I don't know, like the process like that. So yeah.
Yeah. So in my practice, I usually spend 60 minutes with my clients and the actual clinical part really doesn't take a lot of time. Most of it is spent on prenatal education. So talking about how to take care of themselves, because most of the prenatal care, if we're real about it, most of the prenatal care actually happens in a person's home, right? What they're putting into their bodies, how they move their bodies, you know, stress management, are they sleeping? You know, how's how are they protecting their energy? You know, all of those pieces. So really giving people the tools and the resources to create, again, that foundation of wellness through nutrition, through, you know, exercise and activity and stress management. Also provide what's called anticipatory guidance. So that may look like, oh, you know, Donna, you're at 16 weeks gestation. By the time I see you at your next prenatal in 4 weeks, you'll probably be feeling your baby move, you know? And so kind of talking about these things that are coming ahead, some of which are really exciting and welcome, and other changes for some people are difficult or triggering or, you know, and so it's kind of nice to have a heads up that like this thing may be happening. We also do a lot of what's called informed choice as midwives. So really inviting the client into the decision-making process. So any standard of care testing or intervention, we're talking about that in great detail, like gestational diabetes testing. Let's talk about what that is. Why is it even important? You know, what are the risks involved with gestational diabetes? And what are the different ways that that gets tested for? Here's the standard way and all of the benefits and risks that go along with doing the standard way. Here are some alternative means of testing and here are their benefits and risks. Now, you know, having talked about all of that, Donna, you know, tell me what's the right decision for you. Again, really invites people in because while midwives are experts in healthy, low risk, you know, maternity care, you are the expert in your own body and your own life and family, you know, experience. So sometimes people will say like, well, I can't do that testing because I don't have insurance and we literally have no money left. I mean, we can barely, you know, pay for heat next week and we're about to run out of oil. Sending blood work to a lab, you know, in order to get that information just may not be the best way to get that info for someone. And we might do a point of care testing instead. We might use a handheld glucometer in the office to get that information. So just really trying to meet people where they're at. So that's what really takes up the bulk of our time together, you know, during prenatal visits. As important as the hands-on clinical assessments are, you know, you can do those in your sleep if you know your stuff really well.
So what nutritional advice would you give to like a mom? Like, oh, you guys should eat this, you should eat that.
We usually go over a list of things to be mindful of or to avoid, like, you know, avoiding raw meats, raw dairy, talking about, you know, mercury in fish and ways to get in fish because fish provide some healthy nutrients like omega-3s, for example, but wanting to make sure that we're not taking in a high toxin load as we would if we were eating tuna, for example. So salmon would be a safer alternative. We put a lot of emphasis on protein. When you break down protein, protein breaks down into amino acids. And if you go back to, you know, biology class, whether that's middle school, high school, right, the amino acids help to create DNA, the building blocks of life. And so we need a significantly higher amount of protein when we are pregnant, more so than what we might consume when we're not pregnant. Sometimes we're talking about cravings and aversions and trying to figure out like, what is this, you know, what's going on underneath? You know, someone's telling me like, oh, I can't get enough of ice cream. And it's like, well, you actually, your body might be telling you that you need more calcium and that you need more protein. Calcium has the benefit of helping to firm up and develop the baby's bones and tooth buds. And it's pretty common to develop like this insatiable craving for calcium-based foods, usually dairy in the mid to late second trimester. And this is the time when those bones are developing. And so it's like, I don't know if we need to indulge in ice cream all the time, maybe sometimes, and let's focus on other ways to get that calcium in.
That's pretty cool that your body, is that why like pregnant women have cravings? Is because it's like kind of telling your body like, oh, hey, your baby needs this. So like, let's eat this.
Yeah, I think a lot of times our bodies, you know, are wise and direct us to what we need and also try to steer us away from what we don't need. It's really interesting, you know, when someone is really craving pickles, you know, or salty things in the first trimester, right? Salt is a really important nutrient in helping us to start to expand our blood volume. And that starts in the first trimester. And then people get to a point where it's like, I don't need that anymore. Like, oh, in fact, I'm turned off by it. And it's like, okay, the body is telling you something here that it's got enough. Coffee is a funny one that a lot of people are just flat out turned off by coffee in the first trimester. And it's like, it's a time when you really don't need it. We don't want to add any extra to what your body is doing at that time. So yeah, I encourage people, no matter what it is, to follow their bodies. If it's exercise, you know, if it feels good, feels right, then do it. If it doesn't, don't push it. Just follow your body.
Oh, that's so cool. Going to like the actual birthing process, right? So what happens if something goes wrong, like in a home birth? Like I read that there's like an ambulance outside just in case, but I don't know if that's true for like all home births.
Yeah. So the goal in a home birth again is, or when we're planning a home birth, is for the midwife to always, always, always engage in a risk assessment process. And so that's happening at every single prenatal visit. Anytime the client calls in between prenatals, you know, when the labor begins, the question should always be on the midwife's mind, like, are we still safe, you know, to be at home? and, you know, what's going on in this moment, and, you know, what's my plan? What's my plan if things go well? What's my plan if things don't go well? So I always had these, you know, questions kind of in my brain, such that I am picking up on pink flags rather than waiting until there's the big, scary red flag to make the decision that we need to go into the hospital. And in that way, I've been practicing for 8 years as a certified professional midwife, and I have never, ever had an emergency transport. I've had a few scenarios where I didn't like where we were at and felt like if this next part doesn't go the way that I hope it does or want it to, I already want the ambulance here because we are going to go in quickly. And so I've called the ambulance and had them, again, like you said, the ambulance is in the driveway. The paramedic is in the room with me and the birthing person. The rest of the EMS team is in another part of the house because less is sometimes more. And that every single time I've been able to successfully manage what's happened or what is happening, such that eventually the paramedic is like, well, you guys seem like you're all set. Do you still want to go to the hospital? And the family's like, well, do we have to? And they're like, no, you guys are fine. The baby is fine. So go ahead and sign here and we'll just pack up our stuff and we'll leave. And so that's a really good feeling. It does mean that I may be the midwife who transfers to the hospital more often than some of my peers. And there certainly have been times where pink flags have come up at home and I've been like, I could see this going either way. But I think that going to the hospital where we have access to more tools and more resources makes a lot more sense. Or just going in so we can, you know, have a better understanding of what's happening or keep a closer eye on things in case things shift. And sometimes, you know, we make that transition and the whole birth goes totally fine with very little, you know, intervention. And so sometimes that feels like a bummer, but better than the other way of like wishing that we were already in the hospital.
Right. So then like, say there is an actual like transport, you are still with them to help them birth the baby?
Yeah. So, I mean, pre-COVID, COVID has changed a lot of how we work, but yes, if it was an ambulance ride, and I haven't had an emergency one as a midwife, I just try not to be in that situation if I can help it, but I might go in an ambulance when it's not an emergency. So no sirens, no lights, but it's just like, this thing is easier for me to manage and move around in the back of an ambulance in the backseat of a car. Then I ride along with, and I bring, you know, emergency tools like emergency medications that the EMS team doesn't have access to. They don't have a way of monitoring the baby's heartbeat, for example, in the ambulance. And then they have tools and skills that I don't have. And so we get to work together as a team. And then in the hospital, I don't have privileges in the hospital setting the way that a midwife, say in Canada, can be, you know, managing things at home or in a birth center and then transition to the hospital and continue to manage things. That doesn't really happen here so much in the US. But in that setting, then I do kind of shift more in the role of doula and focusing on, you know, physical comfort, spiritual, emotional needs, and advocacy at that point, as well as sort of almost like a cultural broker. You know, the medical team is coming in with their tools and their language. And sometimes my clients don't understand that or don't jive with that. And so I'm trying to like be the bridge between those kind of two worlds, especially, you know, when someone, it just wasn't part of their plan to be in the hospital. And so they're having to shift gears pretty quickly.
Yeah. Kind of just like a translator almost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that said, I don't bank on the fact that I'm never going to have an emergency at home. So I do have emergency skills and emergency medications. There's some things that do come up in the home setting that you just have to manage, like a shoulder dystocia where the shoulders become lodged underneath the pubic bone, even though the head has come out, the rest of the baby can't come out. And we have about 6-7 minutes to get a baby out of the birth canal before brain damage sets in. And so that's something that I am skilled at managing because you have to. It's not like, oh, we're just going to call an ambulance and we'll get to the hospital, you know, 20 minutes later, or postpartum hemorrhage, you know, like when there's bleeding happening, we need it to stop. And so, you know, really buckling down with those emergency skills and medications in order to get that to stop, you know, right. So it's not like don't ever see complications or avoid them, you know, entirely, because sometimes life happens.
So say if I'm looking for a midwife, what should I look for? Just energy or?
Yeah, I guess it would depend on where you are and therefore what your access would be. There's some states where your only option would be a certified nurse midwife who works in a hospital. And that may not be as much about feel. It may be like, you know, the closest midwives are in the hospital and the next set are 2 hours away. Like, you know, those are my choices. Because we're here in the US, I would say understanding your midwife's training and background and credentials, if they have credentials, would be important. There's some states that allow midwives to practice without being, you know, credentialed or without having like formal education, which is not to say that those midwives have no value. In fact, historically, that's exactly how we learned. We learned by apprenticeship, you know, being alongside another midwife. But I think I meet people who just think, you know, again, a midwife is a midwife is a midwife. And they're thinking, you know, a midwife is always a certified nurse midwife who practices in the hospital and has these skills and resources and tools, and don't always realize that that's not true for every midwife. I think you're right. I think there's like a connection that happens during what we call a consultation visit. It's, you know, basically a visit where you would kind of figure out, do I like this midwife? What does this midwife do? What does a midwife not do or not offer? You know, what's within their scope? What are the things that, you know, would make this midwife say that I need to birth in the hospital? You know, and that feeling of connection that happens during that free visit where you get to find that out. And the, hopefully the midwife is making some informed decisions too about whether or not you're a good fit for them, you know. I would think that availability would be pretty big, right? Especially if you're choosing to work with just one midwife as opposed to a group of midwives, and you'd want to know like availability or, you know, what is the plan if there are two babies being born at the same time, or, you know, just sort of those practice logistics parts. But yeah, a lot of it is getting a feel for, does this person seem like they really respect me? And do I feel like this person is really going to support me in my goals?
That's a really good answer. So do insurances cover midwives, or does it depend on the insurance?
It's variable. It depends on the insurance, and it can depend on the midwife's credentials. Licensing is usually a big requirement in order to be covered by insurance, and not every state licenses certified professional midwives. Certified nurse midwives are licensed in every state, as far as I understand it. Certified midwives, so there's one more credential that I haven't even touched on, and they're only licensed in a handful of states, I think maybe 7 or 8 states at most. And so the midwife's credential, the licensing piece, and then the insurance part definitely impacts insurance. I'm out of network with all insurance plans, and so my clients pay a fee to me out of pocket, and most of them chip away at that fee such that they're paid in full by a month before their due date. And then once we know their baby's birthday, once the baby's here, I can submit a claim on their behalf to seek reimbursement for the client. So a check goes back to the client, and sometimes clients get nothing, and sometimes clients get more than half of what they paid. Oftentimes my fee is comparable with what patient's deductible would be. And so I frequently hear like, well, whether we birth, you know, at home with you or we birth, you know, in the hospital, we're still going to pay the same amount because we need to meet our deductible.
How much would it be like, say, if you had to pay out of pocket for like a midwife?
Well, it depends. Which state are you in?
I'm in Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. Oh yeah. So I don't really know what the fees look like in Massachusetts. I think here in Maine, there's a range. I think it's kind of between 3,000 and 5,000, you know, for people birthing at home. And then it often is a little bit more for people birthing in a birth center for those community-based births. There are some places, like I think, you know, paying 6,000, 7,000, or 8,000 in big cities like New York City, Philadelphia, that's pretty well, you know, kind of understood. So it kind of depends on the community. There are a number of midwives that offer a sliding scale where people who meet certain income requirements pay, you know, significantly less. And then people who meet other income requirements maybe pay more. So I've seen here in Maine, like a sliding scale range within a practice of 1,600 all the way to 5,000 in order to make care accessible to anyone.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Hypothetical. Say if like I'm in like the subway or something, and then like someone's about to give labor, but I feel like you have more than enough time. Okay, well, I don't know how birthing works, so never mind. So like say the subway gets stuck, and then now there's like this lady who's about to give birth. Like, what are the things that I should do, like, in case that happens?
Sure. So I mean, it depends. When birth is happening quickly, you know, like the first scenario that you're saying, like, oh, we're on the subway and like, oh my goodness, this person's in labor, baby's coming quickly. When birth is happening fast, it's usually because everything's healthy and well and totally normal, and baby and parent are in good alignment with one another. And so you don't really have to do anything other than to kind of support them, encourage them, give them a little bit of space. I'm just thinking about like the crowd, you know, of observers if birthing on a subway. I guess you'd want to have some resources to keep the baby warm and putting the baby skin to skin with their parent and then kind of layering clothing or towels or blankets over them. We have the ability to keep our babies warm to the point that people who have twins usually put their babies on their chest and one side, one breast will literally be warmer than the other based on what the baby needs, you know? The other piece is I would really, really strongly discourage you from touching the umbilical cord. The umbilical cord, if you meddle with it, can actually spasm. It can also, if you put too much pressure or tension on it, you can cause it to break. And then you have a significant bleeding event for the baby. It's baby's blood that's lost when the cord breaks, not the parents. And it doesn't take much blood loss for a baby to be profoundly impacted. So just leave it alone, because once it's all done pulsing, once the baby doesn't need it anymore, it will stop pulsing. You don't have to like cut it and tie it off. And in fact, you pose a risk of infection. Some people are like, yeah, I cut the umbilical cord with, you know, my rusty pocket knife. And you're like, oh my gosh, like why? Yeah. So really you don't do anything in those births.
I read somewhere where it, like with other animals, the umbilical cord comes off on its own. When does that usually happen? Like we usually just cut it off, right? Like for humans.
Yeah. So it's pretty standard to cut the umbilical cord, you know, at some point. In most hospitals, it's, you know, within 1 to 3 minutes of the baby being born. Studies have shown that the blood that's in the umbilical cord, that's in the placenta, the majority of that blood gets to the baby within the first few minutes. And in some community-based settings, it's more common not to cut the cord until the cord has stopped pulsing. So there's no more blood flow and the cord is flaccid. So there's a variation, and that could be 15 minutes or 30 minutes. There's always a little stump that's left behind of umbilical cord on the baby. And depending on how you care for it, it's about 5 to 7 days in my practice where I don't have people do anything unless it looks like it needs care. Whereas my generation, we would have been cleaning the umbilical cord with alcohol. And that would cause it to take more time before it's ready to fall off. If we're comparing it to animals, I actually can't recall how long that process takes. So there's something that's called a lotus birth, where families leave the placenta and umbilical cord intact and connected to the baby. And I think that that tends to fall off quicker within the first 3 to 5 days of life. And that's more, you know, akin to what might happen in the wild.
All right. Well, I think I got all my questions in. Thank you, Tiffany. This has been so informative.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I think everybody could benefit from some time with a midwife. I mean, midwives we're family-centered. We really want to support people in being body conscious. So even before becoming pregnant, like understanding what their menstrual cycles and understanding their fertility, like there's so many people who have been on birth control for so long. It's like, you know, in our teen years, you have acne, here, take birth control. Oh, your periods are heavy, here, take birth control. And so we've never really gotten to experience what our body does and don't understand some of the signals that our body, you know, telling us, to the point that we now have some great books like The Fifth Vital Sign, which talks about the menstrual period is the fifth vital sign, or the period repair manual, because there's a whole generation, multiple generations of people who just like, we don't know our bodies. And so I think anybody can benefit from time with a midwife, even if they don't want to birth at home or if they're high risk. You know, there's a lot that you can learn and get support on with midwives.
Wait, is there like a midwife that specializes specifically with menstrual cycles too, or?
Not that I know of, but a lot of us do provide preconception care. So for people planning to become pregnant, or well body care. So just sort of like your annual wellness visit. I provide intrauterine insemination. So I do a lot of work with people in kind of breaking down, like, what is your body telling you when you have your menstrual period? And like, how do we know that you're ovulating? And people are like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that my body does this. Or I didn't know that that's what that meant. And I just thought that was a nuisance, you know? So yeah, I mean, they're a lot of midwives that really understand the menstrual cycle really, really well and spend a lot of time working on breaking that down and educating people on it.
Oh, this is so interesting. I really enjoyed talking to you. This was very informative.
Thank you.
But I don't want to take too much of your time, because, you know, you got to birth babies and stuff and work with moms. But yeah, thank you for your time and thank you for your knowledge. And I hope you have a happy new year.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, and happy new year to you as well.
Learn more about Tiffany's services on her website at tworiverslactation.com and connect with her on Instagram at tworiverslactation and on Facebook and LinkedIn at Tiffany Carter Skillings. And if you missed any of that, don't worry. All of it will be linked in the episode description. Thank you for listening to the What Even Is podcast. If you like this episode, please share, subscribe, review, and rate us. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at the What Even Is podcast so you can DM us a topic that makes you wonder, what even is that?